You're listening to the Kingdom Reformation Podcast with Glenn Bleakney, equipping the church for revival, reformation, and kingdom impact worldwide.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're wrestling with a topic that is, well, it's painful, it's confusing, and for a lot of people, I think, profoundly necessary.
It really is.
We're going to be taking a deep, unflinching look at the institutional shaking that's happening all across the Western Church right now.
And for this, we're really leaning on an assessment by Glenn Bleakney. He's written something that it forces you to move past the immediate reaction,
which is usually fear, right?
Fear, despair, panic. And he wants us to look squarely at the optimistic, future-oriented opportunity that's actually presented by this moment of, well, what looks like collapse.
Institutional contraction, yeah.
And the gravity of this.
Yeah.
You just can't deny it. We have to start by accepting the sheer scale of what's happening. Bleakney frames this whole thing around a core, really shocking data point.
Okay, let's hear it.
We're looking at an estimated 15,000 churches across the United States that are expected to close their doors this year.
15,000.
This year alone. And, you know, by almost every metric you can find, that's the highest number ever recorded.
Wow. I mean, when you hear that number, especially if you've spent any time at all in, you know, institutional Christianity, it just triggers an immediate alarm.
Of course.
It sounds like a catastrophe. Your brain instantly goes to fear. You think, is this it? Is this the death of Christianity in the West? Are we just watching faith evaporate in real time?
And that's the natural human and definitely the institutional reaction.
Yeah.
But Bleakney, he really challenges us to adopt what he calls a third way of reading these numbers.
What is a way?
Yeah. He says we can't afford to fall into denial, which is just pretending the data isn't real.
Or worse, explaining it away.
Exactly. But we also can't fall into despair, which is basically throwing in the towel and assuming it's all over.
Yeah.
The third way he proposes is discernment.
Okay, let's unpack this. Discernment. The core argument seems to be that what looks like this colossal, catastrophic loss is actually the seedbed for something greater. Is that about right?
That's it, exactly. He's asking us to look at this institutional failure, not through the lens of, say, human strategy or simple decline.
Or blaming the culture.
Right, not blaming the culture, but looking at it through the lens of divine purpose, what he calls God's economy. We get so fixated on the visible things, the buildings, the budgets, the attendance numbers, these institutional markers of success.
The things you can count.
The things you can count. And in doing that, we completely miss the Holy Spirit-led recalibration process that's actually at work underneath it all.
So that's really the mission statement for this deep dive, then. We're going to try to be brutally honest about the failure, about the institutional collapse, but pair that with a genuine, grounded optimism about what's coming next.
Exactly. And the central thesis that we really have to carry through this whole conversation is this. This season is not just a decline caused by external secular forces. It's a necessary purging. It's a pruning. It's a divine reset.
Orchestrated by God.
To reset the church for what he calls an authentic, reproducible kingdom movement.
That sets a profoundly challenging tone, I have to say. Because if we accept that premise, that God is actively resetting the church, then we have to look really, really closely at what is failing and, more importantly, why it's failing.
That's right. We have to dissect the nature of this institutional mortality.
Okay, so let's get into section one then, the harsh reality and the disconnect. Let's just nail down the reality of this contraction first. Again, the number is 15,000 closures in 2025.
But the context around that number is, in some ways, even more damning for the institutional model. As the political scientist Ryan Burge has pointed out, church closures now outpace new church plants by a crushing ratio.
What's the ratio?
It's roughly 3-1. For every one new church that gets planted, three existing ones are closing their doors.
3-1. That's not sustainable.
It's an accelerating, devastating ratio. It signals a rapid institutional contraction that is, by definition, unsustainable.
And the source of the failure seems to be really deep-seated. I know Tom Rainer, who, you know, specializes in this stuff in congregational health, he's provided a lot of analysis on this.
He has. It's so insightful. He describes these closing congregations not as places that just failed last week or even last year. He says these are churches that hung on for years but are now, 5 years after COVID, finally unable to remain open.
That phrase, hung on for years, really stands out to me. It begs the question, what were they hanging on with? It makes it sound like they were surviving on what, sheer inertia, like a spiritual version of artificial life support?
That's the essential insight. That's exactly it. The closure isn't a sudden death that was caused by the pandemic. COVID was just the stressor that, you know, ripped off the bandage.
It exposed the underlying condition.
Precisely. The underlying system failure happened years, sometimes decades ago. Pleakney really builds on this, saying these institutions were surviving because of basically three things. First, legacy giving. You know, older donors who were faithfully maintaining the budget out of habit and love for the institution.
Right. The greatest generation keeping the lights on.
Second, demographic momentum. People showing up simply because, well, they always did. It was part of their weekly rhythm. Their parents did it. Their grandparents did it.
That was tradition.
It was pure tradition. And third, and this is a practical one, cheap energy. The historically low cost of maintaining a 50-year-old, often inefficient building.
And once those three things give out,
the whole thing collapses. Yeah. Once that demographic base ages out, once the cost of heating a massive empty sanctuary skyrockets, that artificial life support fails. The blunt reality is many of these churches are closing because they were already ineffective in their primary mission. They just hadn't run out of money yet.
Okay, but I have to ask, you know, playing devil's advocate for a leader on the ground, how do you manage the financial and emotional fear this creates? It's one thing for us to sit here and say, oh, God is pruning. But when you're the treasurer looking at a negative balance sheet and you're facing the ethical nightmare of laying off staff you love or selling a building that's a community landmark, that spiritual diagnosis can feel very, very distant from the practical panic.
And that's a completely legitimate and necessary challenge. Bleakney isn't dismissing the panic. He's not saying it's not real. He's trying to shift the framework before the panic becomes the only thing you can see.
So it's about what you define as the mission.
Exactly. The panic arises when the institution is viewed as the primary mission. If the mission is, as he argues, making disciples, then the sale of a building and the release of staff can be seen in a totally different light.
Not as failure.
Not as failure, but as resources being redeployed for multiplication. The practical advice comes down to asking a really hard question. Which is more painful? Maintaining the dying structure or releasing the kingdom movement?
And for those who have been hanging on,
the maintenance is the slower, more agonizing death. No question.
This also leads us to a really crucial disconnect in what these statistics are even measuring. I mean, when we count a church closure, what are we actually counting? We're counting a financial entity, a legal property deed, ceasing operations.
Exactly. The closure statistics are a blunt instrument. They completely fail to capture the missing metric. They treat every single closure as if it's the same.
Right.
They don't distinguish between a church that was, you know, actively making genuine reproducing disciples, a church focused on kingdom transformation in its community.
And a church that was just maintaining religious services.
Yes, just maintaining religious services for a shrinking, aging, and frankly, a largely consumeristic constituency.
Mm-hmm.
One was functional, according to the Great Commission. The other was essentially a spiritual social club built on the cultural expectations of a bygone era.
And that failure to distinguish between the two leads directly to a massive misunderstanding of the actual state of faith in the West.
It really does.
It brings us to this core assertion in Bleakney's article, The Death of Cultural Christianity. We confuse the decline of the institution with the death of faith itself. And I know the Pew Research Center data provides some powerful nuance here.
The Pew data from 2024 is absolutely essential context. If you just look at the headline numbers, it can seem pretty bleak.
So the headline is, what, 62% of adults now identify as Christian?
Right, which is down significantly from 78% back in 2007. And at the same time, the Nortains, the religiously unaffiliated, are now up to 29%. If you stop there, it looks like terminal decline.
But you have to look deeper.
You have to look deeper. Because here's where the data offers a necessary complication and where it gets really, really interesting for Bleakney's whole thesis.
Okay.
While the overall numbers of people identifying as Christian are down, the report suggests that among the remaining 62% who do, commitment is actually intensifying.
So fewer people are claiming the label, but those who are left mean it more.
They're not casually Christian, they're intentional followers. And that is the crucial distinction. We are not witnessing the death of spiritual, life-transforming Christianity.
Right.
We are witnessing the necessary death of cultural Christianity.
We have to explore that concept thoroughly because it seems to be the key that unlocks why these 15,000 churches are closing.
It's everything.
So define it for us. What did cultural Christianity look like in its prime? How did it function?
Cultural Christianity was, for a long time, the default setting. Especially in 20th century America, it was a situation where you inherited a faith identity primarily through your geography, your family tradition, or just general societal expectation.
Without, and this is the key part, without requiring any genuine transformative commitment to Jesus.
Zero. It was the societal safety net. It was what you did.
Meaning you went to church because it was what good citizens did. It was the social requirement for, say, business success in a small town. You sent your kids to Sunday school because it was perceived as good character development.
Precisely.
Yeah.
The faith was useful for cultural integration, for maintaining social respectability. It was, in many ways, an outward veneer. The commitment was extrinsic, not intrinsic.
So if you remove that cultural pressure, what happens?
The whole thing collapses. If Sunday soccer becomes a viable alternative, if business leaders stop caring where you worship, if the school systems are seen as providing sufficient character development, that extrinsic identity just falls apart.
Because there was no genuine transformed disciple at the core.
There was no core. And the systems that were built, the big buildings, the extensive programmatic calendars designed to attract and keep consumers, were all built to support that cultural engagement model. Once the cultural imperative vanished, those systems became obsolete overnight.
So the 15,000 institutional collapses are simply the decay of structures that were supporting an obsolete model.
That's the argument.
And the committed core is intensifying because those who are left, they're Christians by conviction, not merely by culture. If that's the reality, then we absolutely have to look at this shaking, not as some tragedy imposed by the world.
No.
But as a deliberate act of refinement and purification by God.
That's the only way it makes sense. Which sets the stage for section two, where Bligney employs this heavy, but I think very appropriate, biblical metaphor of the pruning principle.
He goes directly to John 15, right?
Straight to it. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away, and every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, that it may bear more fruit.
This metaphor is just so vital for getting the right perspective. It's easy to focus on the negative part, the removal of the fruitless branch.
That's our human tendency. We see the cutting, and we feel the loss. But we have to look at the purpose. The second half of that verse is critical. The fruitful branches are also pruned.
Right. It's not just about getting rid of the bad stuff.
Not at all. The entire process, whether it's removal or pruning, is for one purpose. Increased fruitfulness.
Mm.
It's not punishment. It's not destruction. It's an act of divine cultivation.
So when we apply this to the current situation, the sheer volume of institutional loss we're seeing, we have to ask the hard question. Could it be that what we're witnessing isn't just secular decline, but divine pruning?
The systematic removal of forms, of structures, of programs that were never actually producing what Jesus commissioned them to produce in the first place.
And that is the necessary shift in thinking that moves us away from fear. If we accept the Great Commission, the mission to make disciples, we have to confront how the closing institutions actually defined success.
And for many, if we're being honest, the primary metric was attendance, building size, or buddy growth.
Accumulation.
Pure accumulation. And when accumulation structures fail, we tend to cry persecution. But Bligney argues, and I think he's right, that much of what is collapsing is simply misalignment with kingdom intent.
I really appreciate that distinction. Misalignment, not persecution. But let me push back on that a little. Isn't it possible that some of this collapse is, you know, purely due to external pressures, societal hostility, economic stress, changing family structures, and framing it only as divine refinement might let leaders off the hook for, frankly, poor stewardship or just bad strategy?
Yeah, that's a fair challenge. And of course, secular pressures exist. No one's denying that.
Yeah.
But Bligney's point, I think, is that the external pressures only destroy what was already weak.
Okay.
A truly healthy disciple-making body can and does withstand cultural hostility. How do we know this? We just have to look at the early church.
Right.
They conquered the Roman Empire. A hostile, violent, pagan culture, without owning a single piece of property, without a single professional staff member, and without multi-million dollar budget.
Because they were built for multiplication, not accumulation.
Exactly. They were therefore structurally immune to the decline of what you might call cultural paganism. Their identity wasn't tied to the approval of the empire.
That concept of structural immunity is so key. If your system is built for people to gather and consume, it's incredibly vulnerable to consumer tastes and cultural shifts.
Of course.
But if the system is built for people to be equipped and sent out, its success is measured by transformation out in the world, not comfort inside the building.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, We can see that God is allowing the collapse of structures that were designed to gather and hold people and resources, structures designed for institutional maintenance.
They weren't built to systematically equip and deploy people out into the world to make new reproducing disciples.
No. If the structure is producing programs but not disciples, the structure is misaligned. God, in his sovereignty, allows that misalignment to become visible, then painful, and ultimately unsustainable.
Which forces every pastor, every board member, every leader to ask that brutal question, by the metric of creating reproducing disciples, how many of those 15,000 closing churches were truly succeeding?
That level of honesty is painful. It feels like an attack.
Right.
But it's the only path to actual renewal.
And this pattern of purification, it's not new, is it? It seems to be a recurring theme throughout church history.
Oh, absolutely. Institutional decay very frequently precedes massive spiritual renewal, because institutionalization often leads to the centralization of power, the hoarding of resources, and the professionalization of functions that should belong to every single believer.
I mean, you look at the widespread institutional corruption that defined the pre-Reformation church. That decline didn't kill faith.
Not at all. It created the fertile ground for Luther and Calvin and others to rediscover core truths and ignite a spiritual explosion that changed the world. The institutional structure had become so rigid and corrupt that the only way forward was a fundamental reformation.
We see it again in the Great Awakenings in America, right? They erupted precisely when the established colonial religion had grown cold, institutionalized, and intellectually rigid. The fervor, the movement, it was born outside the established halls of power.
And maybe the most compelling modern example of this is the explosive growth of the house church movement in China.
For sure.
That didn't happen because the institutions were thriving. It happened because the state violently stripped away every single shred of physical, visible, professional, institutional structure.
And what was left?
Faith. Stripped to its core, faith purified, decentralized, and multiplied exponentially in a way that no one could have predicted.
There's even some sociological research that backs this up. I know Wesley Wildman at Boston University has done work on Western religious decline.
Yes, and his research provides a fascinating sociological counterpoint to Bleakney's spiritual thesis. Wildman points to four key conditions that are driving decline in the West.
What are they?
Existential security. When life is safe and predictable, people tend to rely less on transcendent faith, high levels of education, cultural pluralism, and, of course, freedom.
And the traditional culturally required faith, that's exactly what those conditions destroy.
That's cultural Christianity to a T. But the crucial takeaway, and this is so important, is that these conditions don't eliminate genuine faith. They just purify it.
They act as a filter.
A powerful filter. They weed out the casual participant, leaving behind a core that is deeply intentional, highly committed, and motivated by internal conviction, not external pressure. And the institutions that relied on those external cultural forces to prop them up, those are the ones that are disappearing.
This is why Bleakney's challenge to leaders is so direct and so timely.
Mm-hmm.
He asks, are you mourning what's dying, or are you preparing for what's being born?
It's such a powerful question. And he's not saying don't grieve. We have to acknowledge the grief. The loss of a church building is a genuine tragedy for the people involved in it.
Of course.
But that grief cannot become paralysis.
Yeah.
It can't become a justification for trying to resurrect structures that God, through the forces of history and the movement of the Holy Spirit, is clearly finished with. The leader's primary responsibility right now is discernment.
To focus on what is emerging.
Yes. If the ground is being cleared and institutions are failing because they were misaligned, then the critical question becomes, what does the new aligned architecture actually look like? What is growing in this newly cleared space?
Right. And I think we've spent enough time discussing the collapse. It's time to shift our focus entirely to the optimistic side of this, to what you called the green growing edge of kingdom advance. While the large programmatic institutions are contracting, what exactly is filling that gap?
This is the exciting part. The Lewis Center for Church Leadership refers to these emerging forms as the green growing edge of growth. And these are expressions built not for massive attendance.
Not for accumulation.
Not for accumulation, but for multiplication and deep relationality.
Mm-hmm.
And they go by a bunch of different names that you've probably heard. Fresh expressions, micro churches, house church networks, apostolic communities.
All right, we should probably define those terms briefly because they can get thrown around as jargon.
Yeah.
What is the functional difference between these emerging models and the traditional church model that's in decline?
The key is scale and structure. A traditional church is focused on a centralized weekly gathering. Fresh expressions often work within or alongside legacy structures. They create new forms of community for people who are currently disconnected. So maybe that's a messy church model for families, or a ministry based around a shared hobby, like hiking or brewing.
Okay, so it's a bit of a hybrid.
It can be. Microchurches and house church networks, on the other hand, are entirely decentralized. They meet in homes, workplaces, coffee shops, third spaces. They are built to reproduce quickly and cheaply.
And apostolic communities.
That's a broader term Bleakney uses to describe groups that operate with a radical outward or sending orientation. They often cross geographical or even traditional denominational lines to pursue a specific mission. But their common DNA across all these forms is structural lightness. They're nimble.
And this isn't just some niche fad on the fringes, right? I know George Barna's research suggests this is a profound organizational shift.
It is profound. He projects that these revolutionary expressions could eventually account for 1/3 of American spirituality.
1/3. Let that sink in.
It's a staggering forecast. Think about the implications of that. 1 in every 3 American Christians may soon connect with their faith community through a structure that is entirely relational, decentralized, and radically non-traditional by 20th century standards.
This isn't decline. This is a tectonic transformation of the operating system of the church.
It's concrete evidence that the spiritual core is rapidly building new wineskins to hold that intensified commitment we were talking about earlier.
So let's identify the key DNA of these successful emerging expressions. Bleakney points to 5 common New Testament characteristics that stand in stark contrast to the institutional complexity that's currently collapsing. Let's start with the first one, simplicity.
Simplicity is foundational, and it has to be an architectural decision from the very beginning. These growing expressions keep their structures lean, low cost, and highly reproducible.
And the logic behind that is?
The logic is ironclad. Complex programs do not multiply. It's that simple. If your church model requires a highly specialized staff, a $5 million building, a massive sound system, and a complex calendar of overlapping programs, that model is inherently capped by your ability to accumulate resources.
It can't be reproduced by an ordinary believer.
It can't. And the cost of that complexity is often visible right there in the budget. We often hear that these closing institutions were spending 80% or more of their budget internally on facility maintenance, utility bills, staff salaries.
Just to keep the machine running.
Just to keep the machine running. A simple model reverses that. It forces the leadership to dedicate the vast majority of resources, say 80% to external mission, to deployment, to sending people out. Simplicity ensures transferability. The model runs on relational capital and the spiritual gifts of the participants, not on financial capital and professional expertise.
Which flows perfectly into the second trait. Relationality. The declining institutions, so often they prioritized programmatic engagement. You come, you consume the weekly service, and you leave. You remain a passive consumer.
The new expressions completely flip this dynamic. They shift the focus from casual consumer engagement, the audience model, to profound, deep community. They prioritize knowing each other's stories, sharing meals, accountability, genuine mutual dependence.
And in a culture of increasing loneliness and isolation?
That relational depth becomes the magnetic force. It's the difference between being an anonymous audience member in a crowd of 500 and being a functional family member in a group of 15.
And that relational context is the necessary environment for the third trait, which is participation. The old model fostered a spectator culture where the congregant consumed in professional performance on Sunday morning.
And in these multiplying expressions, there are no spectators. There are only participants. Participation is absolutely essential because it unlocks the gifts of the entire body of Christ.
Right. If the ministry rests solely on the paid professional staff, the ministry hits a ceiling really fast.
It has to. But when every member is released and expected to contribute, whether it's hosting a meeting in their home, leading a discussion, caring for another family in a practical way, or sharing their faith with a neighbor, the ministry becomes decentralized, resilient, and unstoppable.
It shifts the entire dynamic of ownership. The ministry belongs to them, not to the institution.
Exactly. The fourth trait then focuses all that energy. Mission focus. What is the ultimate goal of the gathering?
For a lot of the old models, the goal was the gathering itself.
Sadly, yes. These emerging communities, though, are born out of a sense of mission. They exist to reach others, not just to serve the existing constituency. That outward orientation is baked into their DNA from day one.
So if a structure exists primarily for internal self-maintenance, you know, keeping the lights on and the programs running smoothly, it has lost its mission focus.
and it becomes irrelevant to the culture it's supposed to be reaching. Mission-focused communities organize themselves around the actual needs and demographics of the neighborhood or the network they're trying to reach. It makes their purpose external and tangible.
And finally, the structural engine that drives the entire architecture, the multiplication mindset.
This changes everything about how you define success. An addition-focused church celebrates people who come in and stay. That's accumulation.
Right. More people in the seats.
A multiplication-focused church measures success by what they send out. They celebrate the leaders and the groups that are commissioned and released to start something new somewhere else. The goal is generations deep of new disciples and new communities, not just a larger crowd in the same building.
What's really remarkable about this, as Bleakney notes, is that these five traits, simplicity, relationality, participation, mission focus, and multiplication, they're not modern innovations. They're not something a management consultant came up with.
No, they are a recovery. A recovery of the original New Testament blueprint for community. We aren't innovating a new plan. We're just recovering the original architecture that the Spirit empowered 2,000 years ago.
And the opportunity before us right now, it's just staggering. The 15,000 closures represent cleared ground. Buildings are being sold, capital is being released, and leaders, who are often exhausted by the burden of maintenance, are being released into new, simpler structures.
This is what he calls the Kairos moment.
And the question for every leader is stark, maybe even terrifying. Will we use these released resources, the capital, the people, to just rebuild more of the same? Bigger buildings, better production, more sophisticated programming?
Or will we choose the radical path of building something simple, reproducible, and Spirit-empowered that actually aligns with the goal of making disciples who can make other disciples?
If we choose the latter, we have to start acting strategically, which means overcoming the institutional inertia and the fear that prevents any kind of radical change.
Exactly. And this next section has to be about action, not just theory. Kingdom-forward leaders must resist nostalgia. They have to stop looking back to a golden age that was, frankly, built on shaky cultural foundations.
And they have to reject the prioritization of institutional preservation of all else.
Yes, and fight that constant temptation of fear-driven leadership that only focuses on survival. The responsibility is to discern and participate in what the Spirit is doing now, not to waste energy trying to resurrect what God is demonstrably moving on from.
This raises a really important question. How do we practically shift a legacy institution or even just a smaller ministry from building our ministry, which is often about personal brand maintenance or building our own little kingdom, to releasing kingdom movement?
That's the billion-dollar question.
Right. The inertia of tradition and the fear of losing people or money, those are enormous obstacles.
They are massive. And Bleakney understands this, which is why the steps he outlines are intensely practical and require brutal, unflinching honesty. Let's look at the five actionable steps he lays out. We have to start with the most painful one.
Okay.
Actionable step one, conduct a fruitfulness audit.
A fruitfulness audit. This is where the rubber really meets the road, where the spiritual diagnosis hits the budget line item. Describe this process. What does it actually entail?
It requires gathering your leadership team and, without sentimentality, without being swayed by "we've always done it this way," evaluating every single program, ministry, and initiative through one critical lens.
And that lens is?
Is this producing disciples who can systematically make other disciples? That's it. This replaces the old metric, which was often, is this making people happy? Or is this maintaining a beloved tradition?
So you literally have to make a list of every regular activity. The youth group, the women's Bible study, the men's breakfast, the specific service times, the annual missions trip, everything.
Everything. And for each one, you have to find concrete evidence of transformation and reproduction. Not just attendance figures, not just positive feedback forms. If the only data you have is how many people showed up, you're only measuring consumption and maintenance.
And this audit forces a hard ROI calculation, right? Return on investment.
Absolutely. For instance, a Sunday school program might require 10 volunteer hours a week, $500 in resources a month, and 4 hours of full-time staff supervision. If the measurable fruit of that investment is zero new reproducing disciples in the last 2 years, then that program, despite its good intent and history, is a resource sink.
And the audit requires the hard decision.
The hardest decision. Identifying the programs that consume vast resources without producing kingdom fruit and making the difficult call to cease them immediately. No matter how beloved they are, that time, that energy, and that money must be redirected.
And that redirection leads directly to the second step, which tackles the systemic failure of the old model. Actionable step two. identify your reproduction pipeline.
Right. If healthy organisms reproduce, then a lack of reproduction isn't an accident. It's a systemic problem.
It's a design flaw.
It's a design flaw. If a church hasn't intentionally raised up and deployed new leaders or helped start a new ministry in 5 years, the system is engineered for accumulation, not multiplication. So leaders have to sit down and map the journey. How does a new person go from first contact, walking in the door, meeting someone in the community, to becoming a fully deployed disciple maker?
And this pipeline can't be vague. It needs clear stages and measurable outcomes. You have to identify where people plateau, because they often stop after they find a nice community or get involved in one internal program.
That's right. And you need to define clear milestones for what a mature disciple looks like in your context. And it can't just be about how much Bible knowledge they have. It has to be about their practical ability to mentor someone, to share the gospel coherently, to reproduce their faith in others.
And you have to engineer the expectation for reproduction into the pipeline itself.
That's the crucial part. At what point are disciples expected not just to attend a small group, but to be equipped and challenged to start a new one? How are you equipping them to train others to do the same? If you don't intentionally build the reproduction system, people will naturally gravitate toward consumption. It has to be intentional, systematic, measurable, and easily communicated to every single person who joins.
The third step then addresses that professionalization issue we identified as a core component of the collapse. Actionable step 3, simplify for reproducibility.
Because multiplication requires radical simplicity. The moment your model demands complex, expensive facilities, specialized sound systems, and a professional staff that's highly compensated to execute sophisticated delivery, you have put a resource ceiling on multiplication.
You can't reproduce that model outside of affluent communities with high resource capacity.
You can't. So you have to ask the ultimate test question, what I call the ordinary believer test. Could an ordinary, non-professional believer reproduce what we're doing in their own home or workplace using minimal resources? If the answer is no, then you're relying on institutional expertise, not on kingdom empowerment.
So this requires identifying the irreducible core.
Yes. The essential, non-negotiable elements of spiritual community, teaching, and mission. Everything else is clutter. It's an accessory.
And the practical challenge here is to actually prototype simpler expressions immediately.
Right now, instead of only focusing on the large, complex Sunday gathering, launch some micro communities, launch some simple house groups, document that simple process, and create training that is easily transferable so that anyone can pick it up and equip others to lead. This fundamentally shifts the energy away from sophisticated delivery to relational depth and organic, repeatable growth.
And if we simplify what we do and how we structure it, we absolutely have to change how we measure success, which is actionable step 4. Shift your metrics.
Because what you measure shapes what you pursue. If you measure accumulation, you will get accumulation.
So traditional churches measure the 3 Bs, bodies, attendance, buildings, assets, and budgets, giving.
All internal metrics, all focused on maintenance. Reformation leaders must measure something fundamentally different. First, they must track deployment.
Deployment, what does that mean?
It means tracking how many people have been sent out into ministry. And we mean sent out into the marketplace, into their neighborhood to plant new work, or into vocational ministry. Not just how many people are serving in your internal church programs.
Okay, that's a huge shift. We also need to track reproduction.
And this requires going generations deep. It's not enough to count how many people you, the leader, are personally discipling. You have to track the fruit of their discipling relationships and the fruit of their subsequent disciples. How many generations deep is your reproducible DNA going? That is the measure of true multiplication health.
And finally, track kingdom impact.
This moves beyond internal church statistics entirely. You need tangible, verifiable stories of transformation that are occurring outside the building. This is the evidence that the deployed people are actually changing the world.
So stories of reconciliation in a family, ethical breakthroughs in a workplace, community needs being met by members of the church acting on their own.
Exactly. This becomes your kingdom advancement report. It highlights what's happening through your people, not just what's happening in your programs.
Measuring deployment and impact like that would radically change the focus of every leadership meeting and every sermon.
You would have to.
Which brings us to the final strategic step, and this is arguably the hardest one for legacy institutions. Actionable step 5, cultivate ascending culture.
It's the hardest because it goes against every institutional instinct. Addition cultures celebrate when people come and stay. They reward loyalty to the institution.
But multiplication cultures?
They celebrate when people are equipped and sent. This reinforces the core belief that the people are the church and the world is the field. It requires a fundamental shift in values, and it always, always involves sacrifice.
And the toughest aspect of that is releasing your best talent, isn't it?
Without a doubt. The institutional temptation is to hoard your most gifted people. The best small group leader, the most enthusiastic volunteer, the staff member who makes everything run smoothly. You keep them because they maintain the high quality of your internal programs.
But the kingdom move is to commission those people.
To commission them and release them into new territory, often with resources and funding from you. When someone leaves to plant a church or start a micro community or pursue a calling that takes them away from your local congregation, you don't treat it as a sad departure. You commission them publicly. You throw a celebration. You openly celebrate the loss of talent because you recognize it's a massive gain for the kingdom.
And this needs to be budgeted for. You have to allocate resources specifically for supporting those you send, even if it means tightening the budget for what you maintain internally.
Absolutely. And leaders must constantly share updates from those they've sent. Make their fruitfulness part of your community's identity. If people only hear stories of success that happen inside the building, they will never believe that they were meant to be sent out.
This entire framework, these five strategic steps, it really does provide the blueprint for participating in the Holy Spirit-led recalibration that Bleakney describes.
It does. It demands resisting nostalgia, embracing simplicity, and ruthlessly prioritizing multiplication over accumulation.
Okay, so to summarize this. This necessary deep dive, the ground is definitively shifting in the Western Church. We are watching a painful but necessary exposure of structures that were built for cultural relevance and accumulation.
Not for authentic kingdom multiplication. This institutional contraction, symbolized by those 15,000 closures this year, is forcing a choice upon every single leader.
And the choice is between clinging to what is passing away, the old forms, the complex, expensive programs, or stepping boldly into what is emerging, these simple relational multiplying expressions.
And we are affirming, based on Bleakney's analysis, that this shaking is intentional. It's restorative.
Yeah.
And it is spirit-led. It is designed to purify and reset the church for unparalleled future fruitfulness.
The shift is non-negotiable then, from maintaining religious services to systematically making reproducing disciples.
And the emergence of these nimble micro-communities, that's the tangible evidence of renewal. We have to embrace the divine pruning and focus our energy and our resources on building simple systems that require very little but release very many.
And we have to move beyond fear. We acknowledge the grief for what is lost, of course, but we have to understand that this is not a crisis signaling the death of faith. It is the necessary death of a failed institutional expression that relied on cultural maintenance.
So here is the definitive statement that really anchors everything we've discussed. We believe this is the mandate for this moment. This is not the end of the church.
It is the end of certain expressions of it.
And those with ears to hear must build with what God is emphasizing now: simplicity, sending, and multiplication.
And just to leave you with a final provocative thought to chew on, Glenn Bleakney suggests that the next chapter of this Reformation will likely be spearheaded by a generation that the current institutional church often struggles to understand, Generation Z.
Yeah, he plans to explore what he calls the Gen Z paradox, why young adults are simultaneously leaving the traditional church in droves.
And yet are leading the charge in some of the most revolutionary, decentralized, and multiplying expressions of faith.
Understanding that dynamic, why they reject the old while so eagerly embracing the new, has profound implications for Reformation strategy. It's certainly something for you to mull over as you begin conducting your own fruitfulness audit this week.
If this perspective resonated with you, and you're a leader who is trying to navigate this moment of massive institutional reset, we really want to encourage you to connect with Glenn Bleakney's leadership communities. They're designed specifically to provide architecture for this very transition.
The first one is awakennations.org. This is a leaders community that provides ongoing teachings, strategic articles, and monthly Zoom meetings that are led directly by Glenn Bleakney. It's specifically designed for kingdom-minded leaders who are discerning the future structure of the church and need continual support and resource sharing.
And the membership for that community is available for $30 USD per month.
The second resource is kingdomreformation.org. This community focuses even more deeply on the structural shifts, providing what he calls the necessary kingdom architecture. It's all about rethinking, rebuilding, and reforming ministry, according to foundational kingdom blueprints, rather than just tweaking inherited failing systems.
So if you feel like you need a complete overhaul of your organizational structure and your strategy, that's where to look.
The time for incremental adjustment is over. The time for fundamental recalibration is here.
Thank you for taking this necessary and challenging deep dive with us today. We'll catch you next time.